You're about to hear a talk by James Tracy, author of The Civil Disobedience Handbook, recently published on Manic D Press. The talk was given at the Lucy Parsons Center in Boston on July 20th, 2002. James Tracy works with the Coalition on Homelessness and Right to a Roof in San Francisco, where he also performs with the spoken word troupe Molotov Mouths.
If I break out into hippie poetry or something like that, just stick with me, and all that. So I'm here promoting a book called Civil Disobedience Handbook. Judging from the mail that I've gotten on so far, I think I should probably put a disclaimer or tell you what it's not. I think what it is, you can pretty much tell from the title. It's not the final say-so on civil disobedience. It's not a Bible. And it doesn't preach against direct action, which I actually consider myself more of a direct action person than a civil disobedience person, or any other form of change-making that people want to take on. It does lay out, it's like a car manual for people that want to do civil disobedience, because civil disobedience of any is a massive part of any emerging large movement goes through a civil disobedience phase, and I'd like to see people survive that phase to go on to the next one. And I saw a lot of folks kind of experimenting around with stuff and getting their heads knocked in. Around it. It just got started. This book actually directly grows out of my organizing. Last year we did a National Day of Housing Action that had 46 different cities do different actions, and ranging from prayer vigils to militant housing takeovers, and it was really, really beautiful just for the diversity that was going on. But I typed up 10 pages of, if you're going to do CD, here's some things you should watch out for. The publisher, is actually going to write this herself, fell behind, and then I talked to her at a reading, said, oh yeah, I have some stuff, so she called me up and said, can you turn it around in a month? I'll pay you. I was like, yeah, sure, I can turn it around in a month. So that's a little bit of the background as this, and what I hope it is, just humbly hope that it'll be, is just a tool for people that are using it and to spark further things. I got some mail from some people that I think are kind of good friends with John Zerzan. That was how dare you tell people to give themselves up to the police, type of crap. I was just like, different tactics for different times and, all that type of stuff. But they seem to have lots of time on their hands to write 20 page angry letters denouncing him as a petty bourgeois, reformist, whatever, thing. So the trust guys aren't the only people that have sectarians on their side. So I'll start this off. This piece was written. It's out of a book that's coming out called Tourist Traps of the 23rd Century. It was written after the Seattle 1999. Direct actions and civil disobediences. I propose that broken glass substitute gold in the nation's Federal Reserve. The broken glass of all our nation's riots must become the standard by which our currency is judged. Because when there's nothing left to buy in America and there's nothing left to sell, we're still going to need something to call our own. And maybe we should stop carrying bills and coins in our pockets and start using shards of glass, so when we reach in, we might cut ourselves and figure out what all currency is really based upon. In Seattle, the newscasters cry, where have all the good protesters gone? Long time passing. They ask the mass to take it all back. They never ask Clinton to apologize to Iraq, or the Gap to bring back the Mendocino Forest, or Nike to say sorry to all the world's poorest. So if today anyone goes home with a new pair of Air Jordans, let's call it a short-term deposit on a long-term revolution. But in between the blue notes and breaking of glass, a man stands on a corner with a clarinet playing a requiem for the dead of Waco, Philadelphia, Acteal. The blue notes and breaking of glass start to repay a debt long delinquent. So with that, these are pictures from the 1930s unemployed workers movement. I understand that folks in this community are thinking of starting an angry tenants union, which I applaud wholeheartedly. We, looking back in history, not too far back in the 1930s when there were general strikes, I consider Seattle to be kind of like the general strike of our generation, you know, as flawed as it was and all these, you know, it was like kind of like the big event, you know, so it was the 34, the 46 strikes that went on. Coinciding with that time, there was the unemployed workers movements that were going on, and it was largely led by women in, you know, poor neighborhoods and working class neighborhoods where evictions were running rampant. It's not, you know, not too different from what's going on in any major city, even with the dot-com bust, which leads me to believe that maybe dot-com stuff wasn't the cause, but maybe the accelerant of our last go-around of gentrification. But here you'll see here, you guys have a chance to come up and see it. These are women that are engaged in come on.
Sorry. No,
come on. This is a very informal presentation, so you can feel free to shout. Just do it quietly. So these are women that are forming, you know, an active civil disobedience. They're taking their kids' strollers out to defend their neighborhood, defend a neighbor who is inside who is facing eviction. Now these unemployed workers, tenant defense things, they were able to mobilize at their height, you know, sometimes 2,000 people in 20 minutes by using the existing neighborhood networks of survival. They recognized the fact that working class people, the poor people, already organized. You know, and that was something that should be respected. There was maybe a difference between the rent parties that neighbors threw for each other in order to help each other to pay the rent, and the rent strikes that the Communist Party and the different radicals wanted to pull off and help the neighborhood pull off, but it's they both rested on the fact that the neighborhood's organized organically, and it was ironic that, you know, kind of a practice of really respecting the what was already going on in the neighborhood and respecting people's kind of self-determination and self-management came from the Communist Party at the time, which shows that they went through a very different phase than the Communist Party that we remember now, of like kind of, you know, responding more to Joe Stalin's needs than Harlem's needs. Most of these pictures are from Harlem, and there was a time when they were actually very hopeful as a revolutionary current going on. Right here in the Mission District where I've lived a long time, my aunts actually used to live there for 25 years in San Francisco before they were evicted. I would love to see this happen. This house is on rent strike. I mean, could you imagine if, like, even four square blocks in a neighborhood that's being contested by real estate interests managed to pull off a mass rent strike? It would completely alter the power dynamics. Working with the Eviction Defense Network, the Tenants Union, the Coalition on Homelessness, I've worked with some of the best community organizers in San Francisco, and I consider myself to be a fairly good one. We have been the kings and queens of short-term victories. We stop evictions all the time. We have, you know, we change laws. We do all sorts of stuff through our different actions. However, we haven't been able to hold back the tide of gentrification, and I think that the fact that it hasn't gotten up to the point of like a whole rent strike or, you know, something really massive, but that's, you know, people are a lot more afraid these days. I mean, they didn't, you know, families weren't under the constant threat of separation quite in the same way. And I think today a lot of times, as far as organizing around tenant issues, you know, we could get like 1,000 people out to City Hall and we could get 50 people out to protest a landlord at his house. I think people are very afraid of turning their home into a battleground, even if it's like, even if they really tentatively only have 3 weeks left, and maybe a direct action or a civil disobedience is probably like, you know, the one way that they could do it, because they haven't, the legal system has failed them, and stuff like that. But we know that things, you know, people's consciousness and willingness to experiment with stuff goes up and down quite a bit. Now this picture. I mean, what I think this picture really illustrates, you know, it says equal rights for Negro and white, low rents for all, is that the organizers at this time really understood the intersection of race and class, and which is why they were able to build such a great base within the black community in Harlem and a base of support. They understood that it wasn't one or another. It wasn't your identity versus your economic status. It was both. And that was, you know, and I think that was a really progressive current as you go back and find out what these folks were up to. And here, this was the first black and Puerto Rican rent strike in Harlem, where they teamed up, and it was actually a lot of the organizing meetings were out of a congressman's office. This guy named Vito Marco Antonio, who totally opened up his offices for organizers and for community folks. He was way far to the left at the time. I mean, he was like, if all elected officials that pretended to be to the left were as down as this guy, we probably wouldn't have the problems and the critiques that we have of him. Harlem at the time was pretty much Italian, Puerto Rican, and black, with some Jewish and some Polish folks mixed in, and he really had this vision of uniting folks around a class line, and he let people organize, you know, and plan rent strikes right out of his office. And so, I mean, it's like a totally different time. I mean, I couldn't even picture. I mean, no offense, I don't mean this as a dig if anybody's a member of the Green Party or anything, but I couldn't really imagine somebody, let's say a Green Party person, managed to get into the Senate, them saying, oh yeah, come and use my neighborhood office to organize a rent strike out of. I mean, it's just like a totally different time. And as we see, you know, a lot of these little things, that some of these unemployed workers' efforts were really spontaneous and some of them were very planned, but they happened at such frequency. Even like in St. Louis, Missouri, they had a great unemployed workers movement that fed right off of the organizing drives that the CIO did, and oftentimes people that gained community organizing experience went on to form the Nutpickers Union that was really pretty much brought Hormel to its knees, and then also people that were involved with the labor movement would go and do community work. So that was pretty exciting at the time, and so it goes. And this picture proves to me that the activists and the organizers of the 1930s had much better fashion sense than we do today. It's just beautiful, dressed in the dressed to the nines, save and strengthen rent control. There was an interplay. I was like, you know, a lot of times as activists, we like to think of things very compartmentalized in our tactics. We, there's the people that prefer to vote. There's the people that for direct action. There's people that just want to want to make puppets or whatnot. And it's like everybody kind of has their gig or in their belief and their ideology that emerges around that. These folks were about really to take direct action to save rent control. There was a time when rent control was national, as part of a national price fixing to deal with the Depression era stuff, to kind of try to hold together what remained of the social fabric of the country. And these people ended up doing a sit-in to support a piece of legislation that was to save the price controls, the market interventions, and I think that's a really, I mean, despite the fact that I personally prefer direct action, civil disobedience, community organizing, and tend to shy away from the electoral stuff, any of the gains, the concessions that I've seen in the 90s as far as tenant organizing in San Francisco have come when the different people with their different tactics come together and make a strategy. And that's just part of the history of the past 10 years of San Francisco. It's not like in order to make a change, you must make peace with the electoral types, or you must do direct action or whatnot. But that's just what has worked for us. We've managed to force a moratorium on luxury loft construction in San Francisco, which was a victory. Force a community planning process in the Mission District and other neighborhoods that will only be as good as much as people. It can be totally co-opted by the developers again, but if people stay active and keep their nose to the grindstone there. and refuse to let it be co-opted. We may see some gains in that. I mean, it's much too little, too late in a lot of ways. But there's still a lot of the working class, the artistic presence in San Francisco. None of which would have been, that presence is there. None of which would have been possible if people were, taking over the .com offices, doing civil disobedience, direct actions, things like that. And ironically, it also played in. We had district elections for the first time in 20 years, and it gave a lot of fuel to a lot of people that ran on the progressive ticket, and they kind of kicked out all of Willie Brown's students in the Board of Supervisors. And although a lot of those people are quickly sliding down the slippery slope of pragmatism and careerism right now, it was that interplay that, like, a lot of the demands that were direct action demands, and they enacted into legislation that has made a tangible difference in trying to hold back gentrification that still goes on to this day. So, moving up here, this is a picture from the National Day of Housing Action in San Francisco, where we got like 800 people to show up for a housing takeover, and it was really, really cool. Homes Not Jails was out in force. They took over this building at 6th and Howard that's really a symbol of all that's wrong with San Francisco in a lot of ways. These artists struck a deal with the landlord to keep this beautiful apartment building that was about 150 SRO units and some family-sized units up on top, vacant. They could have the studio down below, and what they did is they did this installation art thing where they put furniture bolted to the side of the fucking building. They were really pissed when we took over their building. But I really think that artists have, as Paul Robeson say, have the choice to be on the side of freedom or slavery. The San Francisco Print Collective has done an amazing job at, organizing artists, predominantly white, but not only, to support the struggles of people in the neighborhood that are organizing against gentrification. These people are the exact opposite. They've actually colluded with a landlord to keep a place vacant, and I really think that that's just, it's reprehensible that the bohemian community would tolerate that, because there is, art, any healthy community involves art, whether it's political or not, and any artistic community that's worth its time would call that out on the carpet and say, hey, there were 200 people living in that building before you struck this deal with the landlord to kind of be the vacant plantation overseers or whatnot. So it was a civil disobedience. And again, there was this weird interplay with the call for the National Affordable Housing Trust Fund. When we were approached to work on that, we were like, nah, we ain't doing none of your postcard campaigns to get something through Congress. But we struck a deal with some of the policy, what do we call them, wonks, policy analyst folks that are doing some respectable work, that we would participate in their campaign to get a housing production bill done if we could talk about the unemployed workers movements and stuff that really brought the reforms of public housing, of rent control, all those things to fruition was direct action, and also if we could take some direct action against senators and congressmen. We had 46 cities last year do it on November 14th, and it was, like I mentioned in the beginning, and it was really beautiful to see it, to see people working together, to see different things. And 800 people, we had a little housing reality tour through the Tenderloin, and in order to prepare people for a civil disobedience that was going to happen in their neighborhood, we walked to the streets, we walked into the shelters, we walked into the SROs and said, hey, this is what's going on, do you have any ideas? We want to know where people have been evicted, we want to know people who have fought back their evictions. And so each part on this housing reality tour, families came out and spoke about their experience with housing. So when we walked through this neighborhood, people were jumping out of the SROs, coming down, picking up garbage cans, walking with us, and it was really beautiful. And we were able, since we attached radical tactics to a reference but useful campaign, we were able to talk with, you know, talk with people that we haven't talked with before. The religious community came out, the day laborers of San Francisco, their union, immigrants came out, and lots of moms with strollers came out, and we had a kind of like a spontaneous reclaim the streets action outside of the squad as people were inside. People broke out the sound systems, the boom box, and just talked to each other. And for the, you know, it was a temporary autonomous zone in a lot of ways, because people who would never ever have a chance to talk to each other, the punk rockers, the immigrants, the moms, workers, the unions really, really turned out for this. We did a lot of prep work with rank and file union folks. And so it was a small victory on that. And we are going to do another National Day of Housing Action, November 14th of this year. And it's very autonomous, very decentralized. You basically fill out a card and say, I'm going to do something, and you register your thing on a website that we'll have up and do some report backs. And so we're trying to bring the spirit of the 1930s unemployment movement and update it. And we can't do it without your guys' help, energies, critiques, ideas, and things like that. So, wrapping up, check out this book. AK Press called it the perfect book for a younger sibling who's starting down that glorious road of activism. Peter Byrne, who was actually an ex-Maoist who became a neoconservative critic who wrote stuff against rent control, actually wrote this wonderful review of it in San Francisco Weekly. And I generally hear that it's a good read, except if you're like the people that write the 20-page, you know, how dare you offer people up for civil disobedience stuff letters that are highly entertaining that come to my mailbox and my email box from time to time. But I did get, I got a postcard from a kid who was 19 and said, thanks for your book. You know, my friends and I pulled off a pro-Palestinian thing on my campus in Wisconsin, and your book really helped us structure something that got a lot of media play and helped us from getting our heads cracked in totally. So that's what we want to do, because I want to keep people around for the long haul. You know, hope to have the dialogue with the center and move them over a few pegs over to the left. So with that, why don't we just talk? Any questions? Anything? I'd love to hear your ideas. I certainly don't have all the answers in the world, or else we would have pulled this off and beat back gentrification in my aunt's neighborhood like a long, long, long time ago. So let's talk.
Do you have any more poems?
Yeah, I do, actually.
I enjoyed that. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I do have one on gentrification I was going to end up with after we had a little dialogue. I was expecting to come to Lucy Parsons and I'd have a bunch of opinionated people ready to have a real good debate and discussion on this. Yeah.
Okay. So you said something like people, a lot of times you run into people who aren't like politically conscious or afraid,
mm-hmm.
and they are waiting and they really can't take any kind of action,
mm-hmm.
Until it's like kind of too late maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you, what have you found any strategies to kind of get people to take chances?
Well, there's two situations. One is there's the old political theory that the boss can be the best organizer sometime, and the landlord can sometimes be the best organizer. As people get to that point, they're like, oh my god, I really don't have any. Sometimes they call you the day before their eviction or whatnot.
Yeah.
And you have to be flexible in that terms. The thing that I really think, I mean, it's kind of trendy in fetishize a bit, but I really think the direct action casework model is probably the best way of building up militancy and, you know, kind of mutual aid networks. Direct action casework is used by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty that can mobilize like 10,000 people at, you know, a week's notice or whatnot. And because of that, people like think that they have like their recipe for revolution. They don't, but direct action casework basically means like if I were to come into your office and say, hey, I'm being cut off of food stamps, you would actually help me fill out the appeals, you know, and work within the system. And then if the, you know, but all along having a dialogue, you know, hey, you know, we may have to do a protest on this, whatnot, inviting people to, you know, to events. And then, you know, if the you manage to help somebody through the system, you know, you've taught somebody how to, you know, how to self-advocate, and you're kind of using it each one teach one model. They could then teach that to a neighbor. And then if they fail, you know, like, hey, you know, we have a phone list of other people that have gone through this. Why don't we go down to the welfare office and go scream at your caseworker and demand that he give you your food stamps? And that's really what happened in the 1930s, and I think that's probably kind of like the best, one of the best models for anti-poverty work right now, because it's very, you know, it's very hands-on and stuff like that. I would really like to move towards that at Right to a Roof, which is part of the coalition where I work for, as some of these little campaigns that we're working on start to wind down.
In this direct action casework and in the stuff you've been doing, to what extent is it people who haven't been activists before doing the action, the direct action of the civil disobedience, as opposed to the activist, either paid organizer or politico?
It changed from year to year. Really, like, you know, if you look at, you know, San Francisco, like, there's times where, like, it's all people directly affected by the issue. Then sometimes it's like, you know, those of us that, like, woke up when we're five and picketed our kindergarten teacher, and we've been doing it ever since, type of stuff. What I see is, you know, working at the Coalition on Homeless, like, about 70% of all everybody is, like, formerly homeless, you know, or currently. The way that we deal with it internally, not answering your question directly, is that direct action of civil disobedience isn't just the people that are taking the risk. It's a plan that you set out where you have a press person, you have a police liaison, you have the video person, you have a safe zone where people can just go across the street and hold a sign, and you basically just give people you know, really informed assessments of where you think the risks are, and you let people, you know, self-select after being totally honest with folks about what, you know, what are the likely consequences and stuff like that. And that's worked for us. This past year has been really good for us at the Coalition. We've constantly had people that have been, like, right on the line of, like, the criminal justice system coming out for demonstrations and stuff like that because of that. I mean, and you're used to living there. You've seen that go up and down, where it's like, you know, new College of California students, you know, take over a vacant building, which is useful and agitational and stuff, but it's not going to be the thing that, like, really changes things. Can I answer that okay?
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
How is the book laid out? Is it a lot of technique of civil disobedience?
Yeah, it's bare bones. I mean, first of all, you're going to notice a lot of things that are missing from it, and that's intentional. It's meant to be like, here's some brief history, here's a historical essay that was written about, here's the Ruckus Society Media Manual, and here's, like, just your basic stuff that you got to cover. Because I really believe that in each city, each region, each neighborhood, the way that civil disobedience is going to play out is going, and the things that you have to adjust are going to be different. So it's meant to be a bare bones thing. One reviewer called it civil disobedience for dummies. I prefer for beginners, you know. So, but that's basically what it was strategically meant, just to be like, here's, you know, your role of the police liaison, here's the videographer, you know. So that way it's totally useful, but also leaves room for you to adapt things to your own neighborhood. And I would assume that most people in this room already have a fair amount of experience with this stuff, but I still think it's a good resource. I found myself when we took over a college's board meeting, because they demolished two SROs and they were going to put a big parking garage, 800 800 cars in the Tenderloin, the densest neighborhood. And we actually shut their stuff down, and we actually just signed the agreement yesterday where they're going to do 190 low-income units on top of two garages. So civil disobedience has scored us our Tenderloin neighborhood a massive thing. But I look back at it when I was planning it because I was like, just forgetting stuff, you know, like, we should get someone, you know, who can do that for us. We can, you know, just having that, it's a good resource. And we, my publisher was really cool. She kept it at $10 when she probably could have charged $15 for it. So that's that. So.
What's an SRO?
Oh, a single room occupancy hotel, otherwise known as a residential hotel, welfare hotel, hotel motel. Governments have a really bad habit of tearing those things down in redevelopment efforts all across the country.
I'm wondering, things I've been thinking about is how anarchists can get involved in the type of organizing you're talking about yourself. You have, I assume, a job at coalition has a lot of grassroots support, isn't an anarchist group per se.
Okay.
And while others, anarchist groups are figuring out how to get involved in this, I guess OCAP has an involvement of a lot of anarchists. What do you have any thoughts on that? How anarchists can get involved?
Yeah, I think anarchists are, you know, at the spirit, at the core of anarchy, not all the like the different like green person versus the worker class struggle people, but just at the core of anarchy is a spirit that believes in people's self-determination and their ability. So I think it makes anarchists uniquely suited to be able to do this work if they challenge things within their community. So how to do it specifically is that you go to people that are organizing or are under threat and say, how can I be of help? The way that they tell you that you might be of help might not be what you want to hear. You know, we might want to hear, like, yeah, help me organize a rent strike in my 40-unit building. What they may tell you is, like, I want you to help me put together a petition. And that's where kind of, like, the dialogue that goes back and forth, where you're like, you know, the Zapatistas, you know, organizing through obedience to the people. You go through the process of helping people with their petitions. When I was working at North Beach Public Housing, who's been to San Francisco? Yeah?
Anybody?
Does anybody know where the cable car turns around in the middle of the projects? Has anybody seen that? I worked there for 4 years, and that was, I worked there at the tail end of there. This was all, you know, this is long before, I'm taking like kind of a 3-year paid thing. You know, this is long before I was ever paid for any kind of organizing. We wanted to take, you know, these projects were being torn down, and it was very unlikely that any of the original residents there would be allowed to come back under the Hope 6 program. And of course, you know, we're real good anarchists. we're real good anarchists. We wanted to shut down the cable car and like show the tourist industry what they were fucking doing. And the tenants of public housing there were like, hell no. Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, folks, you know, like the Fire by Night people when they were still anarchists and not Maoist, before they became Freedom Road socialist group, they worked with us a lot. And people were like, you know, absolutely not. It was actually, well, not everybody, but it was actually, we actually lost a Democratic vote to shut down the cable car to demonstration by one vote, and we abided by it. But the tenants decided, you know, like, hey, do research. They told us to just research all the money. Follow the money. And they were like, no, you know, we need to do more research. So we did. We told them, we did what the community that we were serving told us. We did research, and we found out that HUD was going to take back $50 million from the housing authority if they didn't start moving people out. So people basically, decided to do a vote with your butt campaign, where they said, I refuse to move until these 10 demands around relocation from below are accomplished in a legally binding form that will, you know, basically, you know, force them through contractual stuff to comply, because it would cost them enough money in class action lawsuits if they backed out of it. So people refused to move out of North Beach until these demands were accomplished, and it was really beautiful. We got these posters to sign the contract in English, Spanish, and Chinese in every single window in the projects, and the housing authority backed down and signed this contract. And now you go, they're about half demolished and other half are still up, but these townhouses are going up that people are going to be able to move back into. And people got their section, not only a Section 8 voucher, but they actually got assistance in finding a sane place to move to. And it's taken a lot of follow-up work. The housing authority with their developer has tried to back out of it twice, and each time the tenants have really fiercely beat it back. You know, we wanted to shut down the new cable car. You know, they wanted to do kind of individual sit-ins by sitting, refusing to move out of their units. But they also did, designed plans that if one person was retaliated against, they'd all go down to the Housing Authority Commission and demand that the eviction be rescinded or whatnot. And a lot of it was built backtracking a lot off of a lot of tenants were being beat up, not by the police, but by the private security guards there. And we helped them organize just a cop watch with video cameras that was really helpful in building up people's bravery and organizational skills. And so a lot of those things are built, and that's how I really think, just like listening how anarchists can engage. It's just a matter of listening, trying by doing, being honest with when you make miscalculations and mistakes, because they're going to come up. And if you try to front on it, people are never going to want to work with you again if you try to cover it up. And if you just be like, look, we made a mistake, in our partnership here, then people generally invite you back and tolerate you things like that. Another, as a side note, we used to be called Eviction Defense Network, EDN, used to be called OIB at North Beach, because we had a bunch of anarchists that all had green hair and blue hair. Half of our membership were anarchists that came with totally torn, patched up clothes and the whole bit. And the other half were like moms that actually lived in another development. And so, at the time I was really shy about being able, as a coordinator, being able to assert a dress code. But after we got some feedback from the tenants, I instituted no holes. If you have, if you have colored hair, you got to wear a hat. So people just ended up showing up in black all the time. And so the moms that lived at this other development that were part of it, and it was actually a really remarkable time because the punkers and these moms that were mostly like Baptist, church going women that had some experience with civil rights movements, they got along really well. It was like this really cool exchange. It was just like the right combination of personalities and whatnot. So then the moms started wearing all black in solidarity with the punkers. So we ended up becoming OIB. They would always call us organizers in black because I had to institute that thing, especially after one wonderful woman started showing up to the projects trying to do outreach with, she had this like kind of fur jacket on, and she snuck a rat with her, a pet rat. And I'm sitting there after outreach, doing what organizers do, is like compiling all the information into a database and things like that. What did people hear back, the addresses that you hit. And I get this phone call and I hear James, it's Vernell. Hey, Vernell. Vernell was a very, very, very active woman in the public housing activist scene. We have enough rats in public housing. Now, you know, this woman that you had knock on my door is a real sweetheart, but I almost knocked her with a broom, And I was like, oh, shit. So I was like, all right, not only do you have to wear hats, cover up your colored hair, and wear no patches if you're trying to do outreach here, but you also had to keep your rat in its cage, back at home. Or the office. We were flexible on that. So those are just the things that you learn by doing, and learn by being respectful. Like, community people will tell you what's up in their community, and if you're consistent, you show up on time and, ask questions and listen, you'll figure out how to inject anarchist ideals into the projects that you're working on. Because people generally in their hearts don't want an organization, a government, a bureaucracy or anybody telling them how to fucking live. And generally, generally, if you package anarchist ideals of direct participation and empowerment and those type of things into something that makes sense to people's everyday lives, that answers their need for empowerment, for food, for housing, people will try it. You know, people will try things, and it won't be in the form that you envisioned ever. And that's what you learn by doing. So, anything else? We had a request for poetry, so those of you who don't request poetry normally stick with us. It's only two small pieces here. You guys ever seen Kapow books? They're really good. They're the best thing that ever happened to us poets, because they bring underground comic book artists together with underground poets, and so people who would, I fucking hate poetry, will check it out, because we have really hit people illustrating us and have a little rep, and they find out that poetry doesn't suck as badly as they thought it did. I even got, I get postcards from this book a lot saying, oh wow, I didn't realize. I bought it because Gabby Gamboa, who's a pretty well-known comic artist, illustrated it, but your poetry doesn't suck. They never say it's good, they just say it doesn't suck, you know, because poetry can definitely be an acquired taste, but to me it's part of what keeps me sane and keeps me going. It's just to be able to step outside. I work with 8 comrades that are all activists and also do poetry. We're at Molotov now, so we'll probably come back sometime through here and try to do some pieces. And that's an experience. So, the 2 pieces, one of a Rally of the Troops piece, and one in memory of a really great activist who was homeless a long time in San Francisco, native son of San Francisco, and he died, but he died twice. So this was about the first time he died. He was part of the Mission Agenda. Mike, he was pronounced dead a few days ago in Skid Row. Hasn't been the same since. How it all happens depends on who you talk to. Some said he was partying with his sister in a hotel room and the alcohol mixed with a prescription drug. Mama said it was AIDS, and others said it was a heart attack. Then there's Chocolate, the sweetest Billie Holiday voice on the set. She cried and cried and swore to get sober this time. Amidst a sea of shopping carts, everyone cried and remembered something about Mike. Mike, the neighborhood activist. Mike, the old-timer. Mike, the singer of them nasty songs. Mike, the one who could always make everyone laugh, who would never put the cinch jacket on. And if he could ever have anything done wrong, he wasn't going to have those things brought up today. But 24 hours later, Mike got off the Mission 14 bus, and some fainted, and some stared in disbelief. Could it be that Mike Dorn walked amongst the living once more? Well, yeah, his heart had stopped that night, and people are still arguing about how that happened. But his sister, who was with him, ran out of General Hospital, back to Mission Street, and told everyone she had watched her brother flatline. Then she disappeared too, never to be heard from again. The catch was that 5 minutes later, the doctor brought him back from the dead, which was a miracle, but since it was public health, he was kicked out of the hospital the next day. But remember, it took Jesus 3 days to get back from the dead, and it took Mike 5 minutes. Call this one up in the memory bank. Alright, so this one was completed. It was in the Tenant Times in San Francisco years ago, but it was completed when my aunts were kicked out of the Mission District. It was kind of like It's a vision of what a city could actually look like. Won't you give me the city with the freaks and the fairies, the punks and the pansies, the Latinos, the lowriders, the sailing ships, immaculate Italian grandmothers hailing Mary, and a little cash to hail a cab from time to time. Give me a dark mulatto city, a Spanglish town, a Chinatown, a Pinoy town, an artist town, a shut itself down, general strike kind of town, where we all better know what to do when the lights go down, when the gentrified return like a tribe of Moses,
and the unforgiving classes, they ain't going to have to wait in line anymore. Give me the city that has never existed. Problem. It's a production problem, my friends. As in, produce some more cash from your pockets, more checks from your books, or some more blood from your veins. Or maybe it's a labor problem, as in the labor of people who built the city as soon as they got off the boat. Let's talk about sweatshops, not in Indonesia or Taiwan, but Cap Street, Minute Street, Kearney Street. Or the one around the corner from the Homes Not Jail squat that was evicted by a bunch of trust fund punk rockers with baseball bats because Daddy Warbucks just bought the kids a brand new live-work loft in the ghetto. I saw one of those kids washing his sports utility vehicle outside his new home. The Jeep had a bumper sticker on it that said, get this, question authority. But who is the authority now here, I ask you? Won't you give me the city with the freaks and the fairies, the punks and the pansies, the Latinos, the lowriders, the sailing ships, immaculate Italian grandmothers, hailing Mary, and a little cash to hail a cab from time to time? Give me that dark mulatto city, an anarchist city, a Spanglish city, a Chinatown city, an artist city, a no more homelessness city, where we all better know what to do when the lights go down, when the gentrified, they will return. Like a tribe of Moses, and the unforgiving classes won't have to wait in their welfare lines anymore. Give me the city that has always existed. Thank you. If you can part with it, I'd love to sell you a civil disobedience book, since it's hung for the next two weeks until the next game. So. Thank you very much for listening, and when in San Francisco, come through the Coalition on Homelessness and hang out. We'll go for coffee, beer, whatever your particular sobriety level is. So, thanks very much.